Welcome to Eat, Sleep, Wine, Repeat, a podcast for all you wine lovers who, if you're like me, just cannot get enough of the good stuff. I'm Yanina Doyle, your host, brand ambassador, wine educator, and sommelier. So stick with me as we dive deeper into this ever-evolving, wonderful world of wine. And wherever you are listening to this, cheers to you.
Hello, wine friends, and welcome back to part two, discussing regenerative viticulture. So I'm delighted to have on the podcast Wendy Outhwaite, who is the co-founder with her husband Charles of Ambriel Winery, which you can find in West Sussex in England. She also makes the wines. After many decades working as a barrister, decided to plant some vineyards, and very soon after realized that actually taking care of the land and the soils is of the utmost importance. And so she's going to be taking us on that personal journey, discussing using geese in the vineyards that didn't quite work out, how instead of using insecticides, pesticides, herbicides, she's using biological controls. We'll be talking about dandelions and wildflowers and how they help the vineyard. Of course, we'll end up talking about tilling and hoeing, so you'll understand the difference between the two and hopefully hear from somebody else what do they think regenerative viticulture actually is. So go back to part one if you've missed that, because that's a great introduction. There also, I mention a few wines that focus on regenerative viticulture where you can purchase them from my sponsor's website, Wickham's Wine. Link is in the show notes. And remember, the code to get yourself 10% off your first order is EATSLEEP10. There's a transcript for this podcast, as always. So if we're mentioning names like the spotted wing Drosophila, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, we like to call it SWD, you will find that so you can investigate further. And so pour yourself a glass from a bottle of wine nurtured by someone committed to their land and enjoy the episode. Wendy, I have to start this podcast asking you, what was it that took you from being a lawyer over to planting a vineyard and making wine? Bit of a change.
Well, I don't know. My clerk said it was one bar to another, so it's not that much of a change. No, I've always loved wine. And in fact, in the very early days, I tasted some English sparkling wine. In fact, someone had given it to us, and I'm ashamed to say, so ashamed, that we'd put it in a cupboard, having said thank you very much.
And no, were you like, ugh, I know, English.
But English wine those days wasn't quite as good as it is now. Anyway, we tasted this sparkling wine. It was utterly fabulous. And I thought it would be really lovely. We both thought that the only joint venture we'd ever had was our children. So we thought, why not do something? And it's really great to make something tangible that you can share with other people and maybe spread a bit of love and joy. That's what it's all about. So yeah, that's what we did.
Love that. And so in terms of working, making the wine at Ambriel, the point of this episode specifically, I want to dig deep. I found fascinating that you've actually really gone down that more regenerative viticulture approach. And so, you know, when did you actually first plant the first vineyard?
2008.
2008?
Yeah.
Were you thinking in that way back then, or is this something that gradually, as you've been planting more vines and making the wine, your mindset has changed across? What's the journey been there?
No, I'm afraid I have had a bit of a journey. I mean, I wish that I'd known more when we first started, but I didn't, so I'm not going to pretend. So, the thing is, your vineyard does actually respond to whatever you do to it. And I feel that we knew very little. And so we asked lots of people lots of questions all the time. And when it didn't add up, we thought England is still a fairly new winemaking country. So we don't have the centuries of custom and practice and tradition and whatever. In a way, we don't have any baggage. So it's a bit of an opportunity to have a look at what we've got, what other people had, and what we should do with it. And I mean, we're really lucky in England, aren't we, that most of the vineyards, I know there are some diversified farms, but quite a lot of them are planted into virgin land. So we haven't mucked it up. We've still got a green and pleasant land, and we need to just keep it that way. Not to sound smug or complacent, but we're focusing on not wrecking it. So we're starting at a different point. And I really noticed, I was looking around vineyards all over the world, and you could see the difference between some vineyards and other vineyards. And some vineyards are incredibly, they look sterile and they look vulnerable. You feel like you ought to go and protect the vine. And, you know, we all know, don't we, that, for instance, when people were sending their rubbish from Paris to the vineyards of Champagne and it was vegetable peelings, fantastic, all was well. But then when it was, you know, doll's heads and smashed up glass, less good. So, you know, you do realize there's a connection between the health of plants and the soil. And you don't have to be an expert, and I'm certainly not an expert, to realize that that's a bad thing. And then you start thinking about, what can you do to be a bit kinder to your vines? What do vines actually like? And it's no more, I mean, you have a glorious tradition of gardening in this country. And it seems—
Yes, we do. Yeah.
Great. And you talk to people and they know everything about their garden. But the moment you show them a vine, they think, oh, that's totally different. But actually, all those principles are exactly the same. Right plant for the right place. Where do vines like to grow? They like to grow on the edge of woodlands. Maybe you ought to think about trees, you know? What sort of soil do they like? What don't they like? They don't like mildew, those sorts of things. And then you just adjust your practices accordingly. And part of that is looking at your soil health. And that's really where regenerative viticulture comes to the fore, I think.
So is that exactly, this is my definition, the healthier your soil, the better for biodiversity and the environment and the vines and the animals and everything and the ecosystem. And that is basically what regenerative farming or regenerative viticulture is, trying to have your healthier soil. Is that how you would define it as well?
Yes and no. I think the most difficult thing about regenerative viticulture or regenerative is defining it, because yes, the main focus is absolutely on soil health. And the reason why is because, unlike other things, I used to think before I was involved in this, biodynamics, that's it, go and do that, or organics, that will sort out everything. And then I remember just the shock, actually, of seeing copper buildup poisoning soils. And we realized that actually you have to think a bit more deeply. And the reason why we go towards regenerative more than any other system is that no one says to you, if you're into regenerative viticulture, you have to do A, B, C, D, E, tick those off, and tick, you get your regenerative whatever. It's not the actions that you do, it's the effect that you have. So what is actually happening to your soil? And your soil's really the only thing that you can measure really well to show that the system is working. Having said that, obviously plants grow in soil, they go up into the air. There's no sort of non-transmissible barrier. Animals, they manure the soil, it goes down into the soil through everything else that's there. So I don't want to put an arbitrary, it's all about soil and nothing else. I feel that it's a bit grey at the edges. But yes, the main way of checking whether you're having any good impact is by looking at your soil.
Well, okay, let's then talk about what you are doing to have this impact, so people can say, okay, what are the actions? So now, you mentioned, first of all, hoeing. Now, I always get really confused with hoeing. Obviously, I look at, like, it's almost like a pickaxe and you dig around with the soil. But obviously, tilling is really aerating the soil, which is typically not a great thing because you're actually releasing the carbon from the soil back into the atmosphere. So how does hoeing compare to tilling?
Hoeing and tilling are pretty much the same thing. Okay, this isn't mandatory, but where we are, we don't employ any frost protection at all because we're on a south-facing slope on green sand. In fact, I brought you, here you go. Here is our rock. And this is our secret weapon.
Now, everyone, you can't see it, but it's a nice rock.
But what happens is about this time of year, actually, in April, when we're coming up to bud burst, even the pale sunlight that we get here warms the rock up. And that means that typically we don't get frosted. So we don't own
that's great.
A bougie, a fan, a heater, a dragon, nothing.
You know what? You are so lucky because I was just adding up, don't ask me why, yesterday I just wanted to ask the question of how much does it cost to heat a vineyard? And when a bougie, so for anyone listening, a big kind of paraffin wax candle typically costs about £8 to £10. I was thinking about how do you, when you have to light enough candles to heat like a 5-acre vineyard, which is just, for instance, one of the vineyards that we have at Balfour. And it works out, literally, it's going to cost anywhere between £8,000 to £10,000 for the candles to do the 5 acres. And that will last you possibly 3-4 nights worth, maybe.
Yeah.
Because each candle only lasts 3-4 nights. Oh, anyway, it's shocking. So to not have to do that expense. Oh, my gosh.
But there's always a counterbalance, isn't there? So obviously we keep the undervine area covered during the winter months because you don't want to find the top of your hill down at the bottom of your hill. When it's sort of where the frost might come, when you're coming up to bud burst and whatever, we do clear under the vine. And there are two ways of doing that. One is by hoeing or tilling. And the other is you could put down a herbicide. We don't use herbicides. We did. And we've decided that's even worse for the soil. So we temporarily clear the undervine with an undervine hoe. And then once we've got past flowering, actually we let it all go over again. So there are times in the year where our soils are clear and just in that little strip underneath the trunks. And it's really a frost protection thing.
But is hoeing a little bit more, you can do it in that smaller area, whereas tilling, in my head, I'm thinking of you're going through with the machine and it's kind of almost like moving the earth.
It's a very narrow strip. I mean, frankly, the narrower the better. And also it isn't very deep because obviously, like you said, I mean, there are some, in fairness, soil is complicated and I really don't pretend to be an expert on everything that goes in the soil. And the secret is, nobody actually knows. Even the best experts don't pretend that they can comprehensively understand what's going on in the soil. But we do know, don't we, that there are some bacteria that are aerobic or anaerobic. And so getting some, depending on what your soil is like, getting some air into the soil can help aerobic bacteria. But you don't want to go in there and destroy great tracts of soil because you are literally killing your undersoil ecosystem. So yeah, light touch is best.
In every area of life, actually, maybe. Okay, so I think you've planted, did you say that you've planted wildflowers?
Yeah.
You've got wildflower meadows? My favourite thing.
So around the headlands, we have wildflowers. We haven't taken up all our inter-row spaces because we've got so much growing in the interrows, lots of different species that would be an act of vandalism. And embarrassingly, if you go out with your bug net, what's important is you let whatever's growing in your interrow, first of all, grow something between your rows, please.
Okay, number one. Okay.
And then when you grow something, let it grow taller because that's what lets all the different bugs and mammals and birds and whatever go and use it properly. If it's nipped to within a centimetre of its life, so I very often see beautiful, beautiful New Zealand with its however many billion sheep. And I do sometimes look and I think, wow, that's a really short lawn. And that is maybe less helpful for biodiversity than something that grows longer. But if you go and get your bug net out, and you swipe it through your wildflowers, and then you go and swipe it through your grass and whatever else is growing in it, inconveniently, you get more bugs in your long grass and actually different sorts of things. So lone wasps or whatever they're called, particularly like grass rather than wildflower. But wildflowers, apart from looking pretty, give a lot of nectar to a lot of different species. So I think you just need to always give as much as possible and as varied a diet to every, it's a bit like a person. You know, you want to make sure You get all your vitamins and minerals from your veggies. You want a big spectrum of food. You want to look after your gut health, just like you want to look after your soil health. You want to be resistant to disease. What's the best way of doing that? Having a variety of everything around you. Vines are exactly the same. All farming's the same.
That sums it up beautifully, doesn't it? And of course, we know, for instance, when we take antibiotics, what does the doctor always say? Okay, dose yourself up with lots of vitamin C, eat well. Because basically, this now man-made thing is going to clean up some stuff. It's going to clean up the bad stuff, but it's also going to clean up the good stuff as well. So you're going to need to try and put that back in. And so I guess when you're doing normal sprays, the herbicides and the pesticides that you're spraying over a vineyard, yeah, you're getting rid of the problem. You're also getting rid of all the good stuff and the health and the microbiomes and everything that the vine needs, just like it would be in our body, yeah. When you think about it that way, it's a much easier way to understand. And I get fascinated with wildflower meadows. I found out that actually you can have grass and great, anything, just grass is better than nothing because it's still taking some carbon out of the atmosphere, which is one of the major things that we all really need to do. But having wildflowers, they take 80% more carbon out of the atmosphere than grass alone. So already that, just the immense number that can do. And of course, like you said, wildflowers have really deep roots. And I would imagine, I don't know if this is true, the more it grows high, I don't know whether the roots then have to go deeper because it needs even more energy. I'm not sure if that's actually...
Well, it's a good point. I mean, we have lots of, I mean, they're not glamorous. We have lots of dandelions and docks in our vineyard. In fact, the vineyard goes yellow at certain times of the year. And people are often disappointed. They're like, oh, it's just dandelions. And I'm thinking, yeah, but dandelions, I mean, they've got those great long tap roots. So if you've got any soil compaction from your tractor, it's going to deal with it. And there are also certain things are good at removing. So for instance, I read, you know, research has been done in Bordeaux about using red clover in particular to pick up the copper and take it out of the soil again. So if you have been spending a couple of centuries spraying copper, well, I mean, oh, there's vineyards in Switzerland where the walls of the clos are absolutely blue because of the copper. It makes you realize just what's in the soil.
Anyway, I haven't seen that. Okay.
In a way you think, I thought the wall was painted blue, but it isn't. It's just copper. But the red clover is meant to particularly take that up. So yeah, flowers are clever.
But then it's not just flowers, I suppose. Again, the idea is you want to have as much biodiversity as possible. So you've also gone planting trees, more trees, haven't you? Or did I just make that up?
Every year we plant some more trees. I look around to see if I've got a bit more space to get just a few more trees in. They're great. I mean, vines are really meant to be with them. And you look, they share the same mycorrhizal fungi with each other. They communicate with each other. I'm not going to trespass on the academic community that is slightly bickering with each other at the moment as to exactly what they do. But what we do know is that they've lived together for millennia. And it's not just any plant, I suppose, loses its leaves, that goes down, it rots down, it becomes compost, it becomes part of the soil. We know that we never look at what's happening beneath our feet, but we know that all of life is there. And so it's that sort of thing, but it's actually the roots living together. So if you look at places like, I don't know, Chateau Palma, for instance, in Margaux, they've actually put trees in the middle of their vineyard because they had heard that the best grapes came from the vines that were close to trees. And obviously in the olden days, trees were the original trellising. You know, vines would grow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I haven't put any trees actually in the vineyard rows because it's England. I need light and air.
Precisely, which is interesting because I just read an article for Bordeaux. There's some wineries now that are actually planning this brand new vineyard, the vineyard planning. They are going to put trees all across the rows to shade the vines. And obviously, anyway, actually, it's great, as you just mentioned, for biodiversity, but that's their way of tackling global warming, which is really fascinating. We definitely don't want to be doing that right now.
Not yet.
No, maybe in 50 years' time. But oh my God.
The planet doesn't get that warm for us to have to do that. But yeah, no, so ours are around the perimeter. And then obviously, quite a lot of these are fruit trees. So they're very good for early nectar. But we love bees, particularly bumblebees.
No.
Not honeybees so much, because everyone does honeybees and that's great. No, honeybees are great, but loads of people do honeybees. Whereas I think bumblebees need a little bit of an extra hand. They do. So
do they?
Yeah, they come out earlier. Well, they're not in hives being looked after by people for a start.
So well, okay,
the queen comes out by herself and has to build a whole colony from scratch, being out on her own in the cold. So she just needs a little bit of nectar out there. So early nectar from fruit trees. And in fact, our old friend, the dandelions, you know, they are all there for them. So yeah, no, that works very well. So we like our trees being there. We don't like tree shade, but we do like tree involvement, both above and below ground.
And then what about animals? Because did you say you used to have geese? Was it geese that were going through the vineyard? They were a disaster. Why? What was the problem with the geese?
I got some fabulously beautiful pilgrim geese that are really good. They're used to weed tobacco plants in the States. And they also are very effective eaters of slugs and snails, which you don't want on tobacco plants. So I thought, this is great. And I'd seen the cutest films of geese and ducks and things in South Africa. And I thought, yeah, they must be great. Let's buy 60. And luckily, Charles intervened and said, why don't we do a trial with a smaller number? And thank goodness.
Oh, thank gosh.
Because these geese were great. They did exactly what it said on the tin. They were out there. They were grazing and weeding. And I'm sure they were eating whatever they could find. But they're quite territorial geese. So they started attacking the people working in the vineyard. And then they started attacking car tires and lorries and whatever. So we have ponds here as well. So we move them down to the pond. But yeah, they weren't great in the vineyard. But we've tried all sorts of things. We've tried chickens. Sheep, obviously, are brilliant. We winter graze sheep all the time, and they're excellent. And we've also experimented a little bit with pigs, but I think with the you need to have a short snouted pig if you want it in here. So cuny pigs are brilliant in vineyards.
Okay. So going forward, is sheep in the winter your animal go-to basically presumably nibble away at the weeds, eat, and then obviously have a little bit of a poop and give some manure to the soil? Is that kind of the point of the sheep?
The point of any animal, I think, is to graze and do a bit of weeding. So again, they've just come out of the vineyard because we need a short cover crop for just in case the frost comes. And fertilizing is always good, but you need different animals. So if there's a fantastic winery called Antiquum in Oregon, made a very good point that if you buy an inorganic fertilizer, first of all, you've got to transport it. It's smelly and nasty to touch. And then you have to burn fossil fuels to be able to spread it around your vineyard. And none of that is really great. When you have as an option animals that give you nice organic fertilizer, which slow releases. But the lovely thing is they wander about, so they spread it for you. So you don't have to do anything except look after them. And of course, different animals have different diets and therefore have different both potencies and makeup of their manure. So, you know, one will have more nitrogen, one will have phosphorus. It's all, you know, whatever it needs in the main. The nice thing about pigs, I must be having been rude about Noah. I think we should be nice about pigs, because what they do, whereas all the others, the chickens, the geese and the sheep, they will definitely nip the top off any plant growing. You know, they'll do your weeding for you, but the roots are there, whereas your little pig will rootle in and eat the roots. And so they're very quick at clearing. So if ever you've got any problems with, I don't know, stinging nettles or brambles or whatever, the pig is your friend. But don't keep them in the vineyard for too long, because they're very good at clearance.
And if too much clearance.
Too much clearance. They'll quite happily nibble any root, including your vine roots. So don't leave them there for too long. But if you think about it, pigs are designed to move through woodland and move on. They're not meant to be permanent residents there. So it should be a cycle rather than a permanent thing.
Well, we just guess the whole what we're trying to do in with farming and with, you know, viticulture, it's the circle of life that you're respecting. Everything should be just moving the same way that the vine grows and then it goes back to sleep. The whole cycle. Oh, I'm feeling spiritually connected right now. No, so you talked about manure, right? So we've also said soil health. You know, this is great. We want to give good stuff back to the soil. So you also do mulching, don't you? Which is obviously fantastic. You're using, you know, the vine pruning. So you're actually taking pieces of wood, natural things, and putting it back in the soil. But how do you do that? What is a mulch?
A mulch is, I mean, it's the same as when you're gardening. I mean, it's either for covering the soil so that you stop weeds growing, suppressing weed growth. And then, of course, that rots down. So it conditions the soil as well. But also it helps retain water in the soil. So it's particularly good if you've got a very hot summer and you need to maintain your water. You don't want it evaporating. And you don't have, if you had any bare earth, that would be bad. So cover it with a mulch. So it's got three functions. And we just use our vineyard. I mean, we do actually use the mulch, which we might talk about later. But we use our vineyard pruning. So what we do is we lay them straight in the middle of the rows. I'm giggling because I should have warned you about sheep. Sheep do not recognize obstacles. If you lay a row of straight prunings when sheep are in the vineyard, you will find your prunings, you know, distributed everywhere. Beware of sheep. But yeah, now, and then we literally use a flail mower and so it chops them into little bits. It goes incredibly fast. It gets, I mean, we have a lot of worms in our vineyard. You can't chuck a trowel in.
I love an earthworm. We love the earthworms.
But it does mean that as soon as they see these woody bits of deliciousness that's around, up they come and down it goes. So you go in thinking, well, where's the mulch? And it's basically like a magic carpet being absorbed back into the soil.
That's fascinating. Wow. But is that the same with, because you use the grape mark as well, so the skins that once you've made the wine, you know, some people decide to turn it into brandy, but you're using the skins and that's fantastic as well to go back into the soil. Do you use that the same way?
Not immediately, no. When it's raw, so if your skins and stalks and seeds, if you just sort of, I don't know, went and lobbed them onto the nearest vine, I think that would be too raw and acidic. I don't think it would do it any good. So what we do is we keep the mark and we mix it with wood chips and we leave it for at least 3 years. You've got to get the worms going through it in its raw state. Worms are the most magic thing. We use all sorts of worms. We had intended to just use tiger worms, but it turns out they invited all their friends, so it's a big wormery.
Worm party.
Worm power. So yeah, at least 3 years and then it's good to go. And we saw this in Oregon again, actually, where people had put, I wondered what the banks were at the side of the vineyard. And it was literally like a lasagna, sort of wood chip and then mark. And that then, once it's been left for long enough, it can go back onto the vineyard to condition it. But as you say, it's replacing what you've taken away instead of taking the whole time. Give back occasionally.
Now, when I was reading about the fact that you do use grape mark, I think you mentioned about vermiculture. And then my mind was, I got a bit, I've heard it. I think someone explained it to me once, but I'm like, what's vermiculture?
Yeah, that's just me being poncy, isn't it? Because vermiculture is just worms. It's putting worms through something to transform it into a soil conditioner. So to change it from being an unintegrated, there's a seed, there's a skin, there's some stalks, and they're all quite acidic and raw, and changing it into a sort of a more composty type substance, which actually is good for the soil. So yeah, that's all it is.
Right. So vermiculture is organizing and maintaining your worm party.
Yeah. Go worms.
Again, for anyone, you know, you said what they do there, that's great, but they create better drainage in the soils. They help with the soil structure. When I found out about them, I mean, there's lots of other, you know, microorganisms and bugs and things doing things, but I feel like it's the earthworms, it's the worms that are just really, you know, I feel like they're the leaders. They're the leaders of this, like,
well, also
natural.
You can see quite easily, you know, literally you dig up in the vineyard, you can see worms, whereas you're not going to be able to see nematodes. You may not be able to see fungi. Sometimes you can, but, you know, they're so obvious and they're the best indicator that all is going well. You know, if you've got a lot of worms, you're okay.
Well, now, sometimes there are indicators that things aren't going so well. And we, sadly, in vineyards have lots of vineyard pests and bugs that we don't like. And so I was reading that You can spray. You can spray a whole load of pesticide. That's not going to be very good for the soils or the vines. Or you can work with like natural predators to basically eat the vineyard pests that we don't like. What do? You try and get in. They're called lace wings. Encourage them into the vineyard. How do you do that?
Well, you can plant for them. They like certain plants. If you don't have any lace wings or ladybirds at all, actually, you can buy some in the post. But
what? Okay.
But actually, they're really useful because they deal with all sorts of things. So I did once see some thrips that were eating holes in some vine leaves. And literally, we got some lace wings in, and we always have lots of ladybirds anyway. And they absolutely dealt with it. It was fine. And it's the same with, people go, we don't use any insecticides at all. We just don't. I don't see the point. I love it, although I'm always slightly surprised when one falls on my hand. But I love it when you see a little earwig in the vine somewhere, because I know that they eat the eggs of light brown apple moth. And so you sort of think, go there, go clean. That's great. And our biggest thing, which is all down to actually a lovely guy called Matt Dalton at the Food Standards Agency. He's the guy who put me onto Dead End Hosts. And you'll remember a few years ago, we found spotted winged Drosophila in the country. SWD, worrying because it's got jaws that can go through Pinot Noir and split into the skins, letting anything get into it, botrytis or worse, acetic acid. You can make fantastic SWD vinegar, but that's not what we're about. So what to do? And he was saying that there are a number of, because this is a Japanese fruit fly, and so it's not evolved to deal with our native species. So we planted around the vineyard, happened to be bird cherry, but there are lots of tree species that will do it. And they have a sort of a black fruit in September that smells absolutely delicious if you're an SWD. Not so much if you're a human, but there we go.
Oh, I was getting excited then. I was like, I've got to come down and smell it. Okay, no.
No, I mean, it's not a bad smell, but you wouldn't think, wow, in the way that, they clearly do. Anyway, they go and they lay their eggs rather disgustingly in the fruits. And then when they get eaten by starlings or pigeons, because they're non-native, they can't survive the digestive tract of the bird. And so that's it. It halts the cycle. The eggs are killed.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. Because, last year in England, it was probably the worst year ever for this spotted wing. How do you say Drosophila? Drosophila?
Oh, I don't know. I always do SWD because I'm never quite sure.
How do you pronounce it? But this Asian fruit fly. Do we know why we're getting this and why it seems to be becoming potentially more of a problem?
It was imported. I mean, it was literally imported on ships and things. Its favorite fruit is cherry, and we are surrounded by wild cherries. So no doubt they think it's the best area. And last year, you're right, I think there were reports of SWD down even in Devon and Dorset where they hadn't been before. And I think it's because we had a really long season. And do you remember we had late berries coming out from your brambles and whatever that they survived on? And so they were around much more for grapes. I mean, I don't want to mislead anyone. Do plant Dead End Hosts, but you're still going to need to go out there. So I use apple cider vinegar at the end of the rows. Oh, they love it. Apple cider vinegar, something that they think is, slightly fermenting apples, they think is absolutely amazing. So yeah, do that. And you need to just give it a drop of liquid soap to break the tension of the water so that if they go in and drink, hopefully they'll also start going underneath.
Interesting. Honestly, I just think it's so fascinating when you start paying attention to each individual bug, pest, bird, animal. What do they need? What's been the biggest challenge trying to be much more in keeping with the land rather than using commercial agricultural sprays? What has been the biggest challenge?
I mean, our site is brilliant, but geologically, it's on top of a hill that's been eroded by wind for, millennia, and we're on rock. So you think, that's great for vines. Vines are hardy old things. They've, they've gone down for meters. They're very happy. In fact, ours are quite stocky, chunky chaps. But you do think, what about my soil? What about the planet? What about everything else? And I have to say, when we started, as I say, it was virgin land. Nothing had happened to it. I think maybe some sheep had grazed after the war, but that was about it. And so there was nothing that had been done to it. But obviously we test it. We see how it is every year. And it's been really great having started with something that was, you know, quite rocky and quite thin. And to see, you know, all the little indicators, not only what's growing in it, you know that there are a billion things living in it. You know, I'm dismissive about, you know, nematodes and whatever, but actually they do a fantastic job. It's just I can't see them, so they're hardly pets. But, you know, it is amazing to see that in a really short period of time, you can positively affect something. It's life enhancing, literally life enhancing.
Oh, amazing. So actually, the work you've put in, you are seeing the results, full stop. That's beautiful. That's amazing. And so healthier soils should indicate healthier vines, which, you know, in theory should mean that our fruit is better, meaning that the wine is better. So I am going to open up, yay, one, yeah, ta-da, your bottle of Blanc de Noir 2016. I didn't open it until this moment because everybody likes to hear a pop. So, you know, we will open it in a moment. So tell me, I mean, I've tasted several of your wines, always loved them. You're very patient. You do a lot longer aging on the lees. We're talking, everybody listening, sorry, we're talking about traditional method sparkling wine, not still wine. Is that just because, again, for you, quality, a certain style, or just, yeah, you decided, you know, you've got the time?
I think England is a fantastic place to grow grapes because you have that really lovely long growing season. And I always think it's just like Scottish raspberries. Scottish raspberries are the best in the world. And the reason why is that they just ripen really slowly. You don't get this huge spike of sugar and whatever. They just gently take their time. And I think grapes are the same. And we personally, although we've experimented with malolactic conversion, we tend to avoid it. And if you're going to avoid it, then you need a really long time on the bottle these just so everything integrates and mellows. So I hope you like this.
Straight away, just sorry, I haven't even tasted it. It's like a strawberry cheesecake, everybody. I'm smelling a strawberry cheesecake. It's a real fruity, giving, lots of red fruits. Anyway, sorry, carry on. I just want everyone to know I'm enjoying my sniff of strawberry cheesecake. Okay.
So we tend to leave them on the bottle lees for a bit long. So that one's had 5 years on the bottle lees. That particular wine is made, we vinify by clone separately. So this particular one, I can tell you, is from a Pinot clone called 777. With it's 98% of it is Pinot Noir. And then there's just a tiny 2% of Pinot Meunier. But it's important that you know that I personally look after the Meunier. So every little percentage counts.
I love that. Oh, why only 2% of Meunier? Just because you haven't got as much planted, or what's your reason?
We don't have as much planted, but actually for this particular wine, it was really for the nose. I think that Meunier really comes through. Meunier in different places does different things, but our Meunier is much more for the nose and not really for the palate, I find. So yeah, it's just a little seasoning really of the fantastic. I mean, don't tell the others, but 777 is my favorite Pinot Noir clone.
I've tasted 777. I've talked about it, I think, only on just a few podcasts alone. And actually, as a Pinot Noir, I really like the structure. I like the fact that you get really red and darker fruits in this kind of, even like a gravelly, it's a strong Burgundy clone. I like it. This, do you know, okay, so this one, I love. The nose is so giving, really fruit driven. But actually on the palate, it's very serious. It's a lot more spice, a lot more savory tones. Very, very clean, very, very fresh. So considering it's had 5 years on the lees, you might expect something to be really creamy, really mouth-filling. But actually, it's very, very vibrant. It's actually got this very, almost like a citrusy zing going through on the palate, but super concentrated on the fruits. But I guess that's because you're not doing malolactic fermentation. So the acidity is higher in the first place. And what I do know, and I've learned, which I think is fascinating, is that when you don't do it, it means the otolytic flavors actually stay at bay a little bit more. So you get complexity in a different way rather than that creaminess. So very crunchy fruit, lovely crunchy red apples more on the palate with this spice note going on. Oh, it's just, I mean.
It's 7 grams per litre dosage. And actually, it's one of those wines when very often when we're with students and we're trying to teach them the impact of sugar on the nose rather than the palate, you gradually give some more dosage to say, well, what can you smell? And what I think we're aiming for is I don't want you to just have strawberry. I want you to have everything. I'm just basically greedy. I would like everything in the grape. And so, I think don't mask it too much with too much sugar and just let it be itself. And it seems to find its way. But yeah, I mean, Charles and I are very much on the stormtrooper wing of, more structured wine. So it's inevitable that's what you're going to get.
It is. The aromatics are beautiful on the nose, which actually is what we want. We want to smell something and go, yummy. And then when we taste something, we want to go, oh, yes, that's got something going on. And so it does. What I really appreciate as well, I really like it, especially with traditional method sparkling wine. You have not just put the bottling date, you have put the disgorge date and the dosages on this. You've got the information that's actually important for somebody. For instance, anyone doing their diploma, their WSET, or just wine geeks that want to drink a whole load of different sparkling wines can actually, the disgorge date, everybody. As soon as you actually put the cork in and now, you've disgorged and the lees have gone, that oxidative nature is going to, the wine is going to evolve. It's going to get more dried fruit and honeyed and spices in a way that it didn't before when it was on the lees. And so actually when you get a wine and you're like, okay, cool, it's a 2000 vintage or it's a whatever, it's okay, cool. If you know about that vintage and the climate, maybe it was a warmer climate. So maybe it's going to be richer flavored, but actually, when was it disgorged? How long has it been sat around? Because time on cork is going to change the exact same wine. So you could take the same wine disgorged a year apart and then they'll be really different. It's thank you.
The frustration, because also I'm old enough to have seen fizz when it was going past me, usually wrapped in a napkin. So you had no idea even what it was. The front label wasn't even on display, let alone any information on the back label. And then when you know a bit about wine and you want to know, and it's so frustrating because it's usually, I think the world is changing. I think there's more information, but it used to be, well, if you have to ask, then you shouldn't know. But actually, I do want to know what the blend is. I do want to know what people have done with it. I mean, I'm just fascinated. I love wine. And it's just so much more fun to be able to recognize, I've done this. And I just think it's great. And if we want people to take sparkling wine seriously, and I think we all should, sparkling wine should be really serious about how you make them. And then they should be really fun.
Really fun.
But I think more information is good. And if you're not interested in it, you don't have to read
it. Ignore it.
Just pass by.
So how much does a bottle of this delicious Blanc de Noir 2016 cost?
I think it's about £36. I really wish I'd looked at my website.
That's amazing. Okay, so for everybody listening, it's a tough job. I have to drink a lot of English wine. Working for an English winery, I need to benchmark taste, right? It's a tough job. I have to do it. I was going to say from tasting this should be £45 to £50 a bottle. Don't do that. Don't do that to us. Keep it in the 30.
Thank you.
Well, that's where I would put it. So therefore, everybody, great value. That's that. And also, if anybody's going to Ambriel's website, get the demi-sec. Listen, get a load of cakes. Sunday afternoon, friends around, crack open the demi-sec and that is more than just fun, isn't it?
That's afternoon tea. I mean, seriously, it's a great thing. We made it under sufferance. I blame Johnny Ray. Johnny Ray made me make a demi-sec.
Who's Johnny Ray?
Johnny Ray is a drinks editor. He works for The Spectator and things like that. He's lovely. Oh, okay. Absolutely lovely. Anyway, we might have had a slightly boozy lunch and he said, make a demi-sec. And I'm ashamed to say that I pulled myself up to my full height and said, no. By the time we'd left, we'd agreed to do one Riddling Crate and we've had to make it ever since. And it's been great. And people are, I didn't even know that this was a trend, but in the Nordic nations, English afternoon tea has become a bit of a fashionable thing. And so it goes a lot with, because it'll, you know, it's got the structure to go through your smoked salmon sandwich, but cake.
Okay, yes, that's true, because your style is not too rich and rounded. Love that, everybody. If you want beautiful fruits, but you want structure, Ambriel is your friend. Done. And okay, so just to finish off and conclude, what's the, for everybody, obviously go and check out Ambriel. I'll put the links to the website so you can get to know them more. You're very small and boutique at the moment. How many bottles are you making?
55,000 a year usually.
55.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we love that.
yes. Can people come and visit you?
Absolutely. We love people. Come and see us.
Love you. Love people as much as you love animals, trees, vines, and soil.
Well, obviously, trees are better.
Almost
second. <comes people. laughs>
Agreed. And are you planning on expanding? Are you going to be planting more vineyards soon? Are you growing or not?
No. So we've got more land here, but the vineyard that we've planted exactly fits the winery. Like I said, we vinify by clones. We have lots of different sized tanks. Theoretically, each clone goes into each tank. That never works out, by the way, but, you know, that's the theory. And yeah, I think, you know, we're not big for an English producer, but if you compare us to, say, a Burgundian, we're enormous. So I think we're just where we want to be, I think.
Beautiful. Thank you, Wendy. I really appreciate that. And you know what I'll be doing this weekend, enjoying, savouring each sip of this absolutely beautiful wine, knowing as well that you made it, knowing where it kind of came from and the care you've taken for the land, which actually is just makes it that little bit more special.
Well, look, I hope you have a really, really happy birthday. And
hush, now everyone knows. Oh, April 7th. When you listen to this, everyone, I will be extra old. You know, it'll be a month down the road. But you can all send me gifts and presents. Don't worry. Now you're listening. Send me a message. It's fine.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Well, I'll come and see you very soon. Take care. So I hope that has piqued your interest in different ways to farm the land and take care of vineyards, but also perhaps increase the love for soil. If half of all of our earth species live in the soil, it is definitely something we should know a little bit more about. And especially when 95% of food production relies on our healthy soils. So essentially, the healthier the soils, the healthier we are too. And so to finish off with, I have a wine quote, and this one is from Jamie Good, who, for anybody wanting to explore this topic more, and especially from that scientific focus, Jamie Good has released a book called Regenerative Viticulture. And in that book, he says, "What regenerative viticulture gives you is a toolkit that can be adapted to place, recognizing that there is no one size fits all way to farm." So this is a subject that we can continue learning about. Certainly Jamie's book, he's planning on doing a new edition when more science comes out, which it will. But for now, I shall leave you guys to explore further. Next week, I am going to be taking you on a little bit of a journey of the white grapes of Spain. And so it's not just about Albariño or Verdejo, but what about Godello or Maturana, Viura, Eren? Have you heard of these? So we're going to definitely be going on a little journey next week. Don't forget, if you are enjoying these episodes, don't forget to share with your wine loving friends, like them, subscribe, press the bell, take a screenshot, put it on your socials, help spread the word. And I will see you back here next Monday, wine friends. Until then, cheers to you.